Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have posted Senate Bill 312, and that bill will not be heard today. And so I will start today by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 818.
That's Christine's.
Sorry, Paul. You told me to wait, and I got confused.
No, Atkins is on his way.
Okay. Yes.
That's my understanding that the principles on 818 are held up in traffic.
Oh, they are? Well, then we're going to close. I'm sorry to confuse the staff like this, but we're going to postpone the hearing on Senate Bill 818 because key witnesses are stuck in traffic, and we will open the public hearing.
Madam Chair, you want to recess it?
What did I say? Postpone? Recess the hearing.
Recess and then come back to it.
Got to get the right words. So we will, Senator Atkinson is on his way, so we'll talk very slowly and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 703. Sorry, everyone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 703 is actually Chris's bill. So I'm sitting in for Chris. It's a proposal that was put forth in 07, I believe. What it does is I can find it. It extends the possible uses for the political contribution credit and adds, if you look on section 1 of the bill, it adds that in addition to political organizations in which the credit is established for now, it would add to a food bank or other charitable organization, and that would be allowable under the political contribution credit. So the revenue impact currently of the political contribution credit is about $17 million, and this would add... We're trying to interpret, you know, how much extensive or additional use there would be, and our rough estimate's about 5% of the what's called the other category, which would include the undefined elements to it, and that would result in roughly $1 million a year or so, if our estimate is right in terms of the additional use of the credit.
Okay.
Right now, the credit has a $50 limit and a $100 limit for joint filers, and that would be retained under the proposal.
Okay. Committee, we are going to stand at ease for 5 minutes, unless that's Senator Atkinson. We're going to stand at ease for between 2 and 5 minutes. And wait for Mr. Atkinson to come up and address his bill. Can you turn the mic off? Thank you. The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is back in session. We have in front of us Senate Bill 703, and we are honored by Senator Jason Atkinson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, Jason Atkinson, I represent a good portion of Southern Oregon. And I apologize if I kept you, we were watching the monitor, so I apologize if I kept you waiting.
We're here to serve.
Thank you very much. Before you is a bill that I have introduced, I don't know if this is the second or third time, quite honestly, but let me tell you a little bit about it. Several years ago, I was asked to be a speaker at a homeless shelter on Thanksgiving. And so I went, and the room was filled, and I was really overly touched, frankly, with how many volunteers were there and how many homeless people, mostly men, were there. And I came to the realization about halfway through my prepared remarks that the only thing standing between those men and a very nice dinner was my speech, which I think I cut short once I had realized that. And it has really, that experience has really changed or shaped a lot of things about dealing, for me anyway, about people who are down and out. Several years after that, Southern Oregon was hit with a several crises. We had a water crisis in Klamath. We had some crises with forest fires. And my dad actually very quietly organized a very large relief effort to several local food banks in Jackson, Josephine, and Klamath counties to help people. And it was a big organization, and it worked fabulously. And to my dad's style, my dad did it all under the radar so that no one would ever know, which is how he has trained my brother and I to be. Several years after that, I don't know how, but some good-for-nothing friend of mine forced me to speak. I say that jokingly, but he was on the board of an organization called Hearts and Vines, and he asked me to go speak to the volunteers of a domestic violence shelter. And I had that similar experience. This time it was my remarks and cheesecake on the other side, so I hurried through that one too. But in all three cases, Madam Chair, I have learned the hard way on fundraising that homeless shelters like the Gospel Rescue Mission, food banks, whether they be local or larger, or homes, safe houses for battered women, the difficulty that they face. As you know, I believe it was Mission Increase in Portland that helped turn around the Gospel Rescue Mission on Burnside in Portland. I believe they were $12 million upside down, and then they got right-sided up. I know that through the network of those types of homeless shelters in Albany, in Klamath Falls, in Jackson County, and perhaps one of the greatest success stories in Josephine County, they have righted the ship, but really relied on donations from others. Certainly, I think the food bank folks could talk for themselves, but I'm sure they would concur that donations have been down. And then lastly, Madam Chair, we know that in times of economic hardship, domestic violence shelters see a very large spike. And so you have a situation where donations are down, but the need is even higher. So I come to you again with Senate Bill 703, which does not affect government in any way. At last revenue count, the projection showed, similar to 2 years from now, or excuse me, 2 years previous, that there's about $18 million in this account. $18 million that the state doesn't count on, but politicians do. And so I have always believed that not taking it from politicians, which would have a very difficult uphill battle in which 90 politicians, 91, would make a decision on it, but rather making Senate Bill 703, making the political tax credit an option so that if somebody wanted to use that money, it could come out of the same fund, which doesn't hurt the general fund, doesn't change anything, but allow Gospel Rescue Missions, Homes for Battered Women, et cetera, safe houses, to have something that they could use to raise money. And that is as simple as the bill is. I just think, quite honestly, in a time in which homelessness is on the rise, domestic violence, and I'm sure you all have heard those cases, they just rip your heart out. People's very worst situation can be helped by taking some of that $18 million and spending it in a better place. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Any questions from the committee? Senator Morse?
Thank you. And thank you, Senator, for bringing this forward. I just wondered, did anybody see 60 Minutes last night?
Yeah.
Chilling story about children and family and foreclosures and food and making decisions between paying the light bill and feeding their families. And it's a very real thing. So the issue you raise here is increasingly timely. The question I would have is the inclusion of charitable organizations, other charitable organizations. My suspicion is that if you expanded that, the tax effect would be far greater than the $17 or $18 million that we've currently experienced. And, in fact, I could see all charitable organizations really taking advantage of this, beneficially, by the way, but that would, tax credit would balloon to a very large number. All of my reading that correctly? I mean, is that an issue?
There's no cap.
Yeah, there's no cap, yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I agree. When this bill was written, I read it, and it's still too broad, frankly. If I could write into statute Gospel Rescue Mission, Food Bank, and Homes for Battered Women, I would limit it right there. I mean, that's my goal. If the committee would be so interested to have that amendment drafted, that's my goal. I mean, I've done a lot of work in the nonprofit world from various boards I've served on, and they're all great, and they're all fantastic, and all their missions are, you know, wonderful. But, you know, for us on this bill, my intent has been people, Oregonians, who need it the most are hungry, abused, or homeless has been my focus. If you'd like to, if the committee would entertain this bill, I would love to narrow it.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to what Senator Moore said, you know, 501c3s, which is what we're talking about, it'd be interesting to know how many there are in the country or in the state. Department of Justice obviously has that number because, you know, everybody that's contributing to those now are taking it as an itemized deduction and saving 9-10% on their taxes, you know, because you're talking churches, et cetera, and I can just see them all, instead of taking a tax deduction for those donations, I'd certainly want a tax credit instead. So I think what you would do is, and there's thousands and thousands, and I don't know exactly what the number is. I don't see anybody out there that would even begin to give me that information. Because these are public benefit nonprofits, 501c3s. There are 29 different subsections of the code with nonprofits, tax exempts, but these are specific to 501c3s, and there's a lot of money being donated right now. And if the intent is to encourage more donations, that's a function of fundraising, which is always a task in itself. So I agree with Senator Morris. If there was a way to narrow this more, it would possibly sit better with me, because when we're talking about all 501c3s in the state of Oregon, that's a lot of money. And your estimate of
Senator, yes, we reviewed this bill in 07, and it, my estimate of the 5% was based on a narrow definition of organizations that distribute food to children or homeless, unemployed, elderly, or low-income individuals. If you take the broader definition, we estimate, this was in 2009, there's about 630,000 organizations.
Yeah.
So, and our estimate was obviously quite a bit larger if you use that broader definition.
Other questions? Thank you, Senator Atkins.
Thank you.
Atkinson. Okay, Jody Weiser.
Good For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So I think you've brought up the main beginning points that I wanted to make, so I won't go over those. But I think that that if this bill were to move forward, there needs to be some language that says you have to do one or the other, or people would actually be double dipping and they could get a tax credit and expense it on their itemized deductions as well, which would really make those donations more powerful. But this would be a perfect vehicle for us to consider if we should discontinue the political tax credit. That is up for sunset in a later biennium, but it's about $17 million is the anticipated amount of money, and we could either suspend or eliminate it and face the reality of fundraising without it. This tax expenditure has been on the books since 1969. The number of people who participated on average was about 5%, but most recently it was 7.8%. And when we can't really fund Head Start adequately and we're worried about OPI, it doesn't really make sense to not put this on the table as well. Thank you.
Okay. I guess I'm holding the gavel here. Any questions for Jody? Okay. Do we have any further sign-ups, Paul? Okay. Well, committee, I guess we could just pass this bill right now.
We have to go into work session.
Oh, we have to go into work session. Oh. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 703 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 818. Thank you, Senator Atkinson. We have we tried to pass it, but somebody reminded me we need a work session.
Gavel, Senator Marsh, you're on a roll.
Description of 818.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 818 would change the classification of a number of properties around the state. It would require that the classification of property be based on the highest and best use of the land. Currently, the properties are categorized according to highest and best use depending on the type of structure the property is and the use it's actually being used for, as opposed to the land is a consideration, but not the deciding factor. The measure would be effective for tax years from July 1st, 2006 to July 1st, 2011. And if these recategorizations of land or properties result in fewer taxes, taxes would be refunded or abated. So there would be a decline in revenue as a result of the measure as it's currently written.
Okay. Drew Hagedorn and Chris Robinson, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, committee members. My name is Drew Hagedorn. I'm appearing today on behalf of NAOP, the Association for Commercial Real Estate Developers. We're appearing today in support of the underlying public policy that we're seeking to change in Senate Bill 818. I would say at the outset that we know the bill is currently composed is likely overly broad. That is, it's capturing some properties that we don't intend. Our focus here today is to get at the issue of property tax assessment of commercial warehouse space, a rule change from the Department of Revenue, I believe in 2006, that took effect sometime in 2008, if I recall correctly, has changed the way that commercial warehouse space is being assessed in some instances by counties. And so I am joined today by Chris Robinson, who is with NAOP and an attorney who practices in this area. He's going to walk you through some of the materials that are before you now and talk a little bit about the public policy that we're trying to change.
Thanks, Drew. Madam Chair, members of the committee, My name is Chris Robinson. I'm an attorney in Lake Oswego and been a member of the bar for about going on 33, 34 years. And for the last 20 years, I have limited my practice to property tax valuation issues. And we're urging passage of this bill because what has happened as a result of the change in the administrative rule is that storage warehouses, distribution warehouses, many storage facilities that were previously classified as commercial are now lumped in with machinery and equipment and manufacturing and processing plants. And that simply is wrong because these properties, if they're in the same class, they should be comparable. And we think they're different subsets of industrial properties. We're not saying that a warehouse is not, if it's zoned industrial, that it's not industrial. But it's a different type of industrial. It trades in the marketplace based on its income-producing capabilities. Machinery and equipment and processing and manufacturing plants don't normally transact in the marketplace. And different appraisal methodologies are used for machinery and equipment, personal property, manufacturing and processing that you use for commercial properties, warehouses. And that's where the conflict apparently developed is some assessors were properly classifying these warehouses, self-storage facilities, as commercial, recognizing they don't belong in that other class. They don't should not be lumped in with machinery and equipment, manufacturing and processing. The result of lumping them together has had an impact when we have new construction. And on the first page of my letter, new construction is just one example of exception value. There are other properties, and I'll give you one example. I have permission of client to share with you. When a property becomes disqualified from an enterprise zone exemption, and what happens under the current administration of this rule. So another difference between these properties is that machinery and equipment, manufacturing and processing, normally are depreciating assets because they're being used up. They're being used in a process, and they depreciate. Income-producing properties or warehouses, we hope, over time, appreciate in value based upon their ability to produce income. And again, it goes back to you use different appraisal methodologies to value these two different distinct types of industrial properties. I have attached on the second page just a summary of the difference between a commercial change property ratio and an industrial change property ratio. And I'll try to make this explanation simple. The change property ratio is applied to new exception value with the stated purpose of bringing on the tax roll in some kind of parity with existing comparable properties. And the last exhibit, I believe, attached to my letter is a three-building complex in Rivergate. Two of those properties were built in 2003. The last one, number three, was built in 2008. The change property ratio for the buildings built in 2003 was 53.3% of real market value. And that determined the maximum assessed value, which drives the tax bill. But if you look at the building number three that was built in 2008, it has a change property ratio of 87.5%. So 53% in 2003 and now 87.5% in 2010. And these buildings are almost identical, built by the same developer. They were just unfortunate that the last building that they did was caught in the web of this rule after it was fully implemented. The department gave the counties up to 2 years, I believe, to fully implement and go back and re-inventory their properties. And so that new property now is at a permanent disadvantage with other competing properties. Why? Because warehouses are normally leased on a triple net basis. That means that the expenses, including property taxes, are passed through to the tenants. Well, if I'm trying to compete out there and my property tax burden is 40 or 50% higher than my competitor, where is that tenant going to go? Or I'm going to have to be faced with the prospect of dramatically lowering my rents, my base rent, so I can stay competitive. Something has to give somewhere. Oregon Transfer is an example of a warehouse coming off the enterprise zone exemption in Multnomah County, and I'm not picking on them, but you just happened to be where this property was located. It was built in 2005 and had an enterprise zone exemption that expired with this year. And the industrial CPR, their market value is $20 million. And their CPR is 87.5%, creating a tax obligation of $316,000. If it had been classified as commercial, the CPR would have been 45.29%, and the taxes would be $186,000. So there's about a 70% difference in the property tax burden. And there's nothing special about this building. It's just a storage warehouse, just a big box with stored goods inside of it. The types of properties that have been caught up in the web, I've mentioned distribution, storage warehouses, self-storage, but we've even had a case where we have a regional headquarters building with some office warehouse that's been classified as industrial flex warehouse space, where we have small office space with mostly a warehouse. They've been caught up. And again, these are all usually, there may be some situations where a property is owner-occupied, but the vast majority of these are income-producing properties. They trade in the marketplace based on their income-producing capability, and that's why their CPR is lower, is because we have a disparity or a bigger gap between their market value and their assessed value, because over time, again, we hope, has been the case the last couple of years, but we hope that they appreciate in value over time. Just a quick mention of the exhibits. Exhibit B I have attached, and this is from the Department of Revenue's manual that's given to the Board of Property Tax Appeal Boards. So their instruction manual, and this has just been updated for January of 2011. And I would draw you to the paragraph with the caption change property ratio. In that last sentence of the paragraph, it says the purpose of multiplying the real market value of the exception by the CPR is to bring the MAV, or maximum assessed value, of new changed property to the same general assessment level as unchanged property. Well, another way of saying that, maybe a little clearer, is the purpose is to bring new property on in some kind of parity with existing comparable properties. And we feel that the amendment of this rule, which was really flew under the radar and really caught everyone by surprise, we feel that violates that principle in spades. Trammell Crow is a client of mine. They are a national developer. They can develop property anywhere in the United States. And I don't think we should be discouraging new investment. We need that to grow the economy and create jobs. And this is just one more reason for someone to keep the money in their wallet and not make the investment, not develop new property, because they are going to be at a competitive disadvantage with existing comparable properties unless this is changed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Could you refer to Exhibit C, the Otco 5E LLC?
Yes,
and
this
the difference
is
between
the
9 and 10.
Yes, Senator Morris, the Exhibit C is a property tax printout for the Oregon Transfer property, just setting forth what I explained to you, what they had an exemption through last year, and then this year they became fully taxable because the enterprise zone exemption went away, and they arrived at a county determined a market value of $20 million and that assessed value of $16,354,000. So instead of the assessed value being roughly less than 50%, it's closer to 90% of market value.
On this Exhibit C, what would have, do you have any idea if this hadn't been in an enterprise zone, what would the tax burden as a warehouse have been?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. If they had not been in the enterprise zone exemption and came on the tax rolls in 2005 when it was complete, it would have been assessed at the commercial, classified as commercial, with a commercial CPR. And that's the thing that's kind of a conflict here, is the enterprise zone is designed to spur investment. Well, this isn't a very good way at the end when it's expiring to say, oh, by the way, forgot to tell you that we classified you as industrial and you're going to be assessed at a very high ratio. And in some counties, like Washington County, because of Intel, in several counties, if you look at my summary on page 2, the CPR for industrial is 100%. So I have a brand new property that's, there's no manufacturing or processing, there's no machinery and equipment, and they're being assessed at 100% of their market value. And that really does put them at a disadvantage.
So the issue really is not the change in the run out of the enterprise zone tax deferment. It's what it's changed to.
That is correct. I think the way it makes sense to look at this is there are different types of industrial property. And they shouldn't be all lumped together. Fee appraisers, when they're appraising industrial properties, recognize that they're distinct types of industrial property. There's flex, there's distribution and storage warehouses, there's mini storage. And I think the department said, well, you know, we looked at the appraisal institute and they classify these as industrial properties, and so we should apply the industrial CPR. Well, we're not disputing that they're industrial properties, but they shouldn't be lumped together with properties that are simply not comparable.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Telfer?
Yes.
You're the CPA in this group. any questions or comments?
Well, I think the problem is bigger than just this issue, and you know, I'm looking at entire Measure 50, and I don't want to do that here today.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this to our attention.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chandler?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I would not want to take a quiz on Oregon property taxation, but I'm quite concerned about the bill as written. It seems a fairly broad approach to the problem, and particularly I didn't intend to testify and have nothing prepared, but when I heard the last witnesses, I said I'll at least put the concerns of the residential property on the table here, that a lot of homes are built in zones that aren't necessarily residential zones. Oftentimes that's to increase density and to follow other social policies that the cities might have. I'm not sure we want to discourage that by raising their taxes to a different category. With that, if your intention is to move the bill, if we can be helpful in the discussions, please let us know. Otherwise, we would simply like to put those concerns on the record for your consideration. Okay. We'd be glad to take any questions as long as they don't involve the intricacies of property tax in Oregon.
Any questions? Okay, hearing none. Thank you. Thank you, John. John Phillips, please, from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. I have a few comments on this bill, and really there was some discussion about property classification, and so I'd like to start there. And And also start off by agreeing with Senator Telfer, this is a bigger issue and has a lot to do with how Measure 50 was brought into the mix here. The classification system predated Measure 50, and it was designed to facilitate what we call mass appraisal, because as you know, in Oregon, we have to appraise every property in Oregon every year to its real market value to comply with the law and the Constitution. And the only possible way to do that is through what's called a mass appraisal system, where you take and you create classes of property, and from those classes you determine sort of where the trends are. Are they increasing in value? Are they decreasing in value? And you apply trends to large market-type areas of property, and then you assign those increases or decreases. You make adjustments. And then there are also some fine-tuning on individual properties that you'll make. So without the mass appraisal system, assessors just physically and resource-wise could not comply with the law to value all properties. That went along fine for years, and then Measure 50 came along and sort of co-opted the classification system and said, oh, and by the way, in addition to using it for that purpose, what we'll do is we'll bring new properties or new construction sort of up to the Measure 50 reductions by applying a changed property ratio by classification countywide. So the classification system, which worked fairly well for what it was being used for, is now used for a different purpose and now has a direct tax consequence, which gives rise to the situation. Classifications are broad. I mean, there's only a few classifications. Industrial property does include warehouses, storage, and distribution facilities. Commercial properties include Home Depot and the small gelato shop downtown. I mean, funeral homes. So when you're looking at, unless we switch to a more refined, detailed classification system, we're never going to be able to, there's always going to be a situation where there's a kind of an outlier or one that's marginally included in the class. So it becomes a difficult challenge to make the mass appraisal system work and treat everybody absolutely fairly with the way Measure 50 is applied.
Every time we have something like this, the specter of Measure 50 rears its ugly head again. In your opinion, because this does seem to be a pretty extreme case of, you know, some of the examples that he gave, in your opinion, short of an overhaul of Measure 50, which eventually I'm convinced is going to have to be done, is there a solution to this problem without bollocksing up the whole system?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we met with Mr. Hagedorn and Mr. Robinson and Senator Morris earlier, it was last Wednesday, and talked about that very thing. And there was discussion about perhaps a work group during the interim to sort of work on a solution that might be, seems like a simple solution to a simple problem, but it's not. And so to kind of craft a solution that's that would address the larger issues. And we talked about the work group, and since that time, and I thought the hearing was scheduled for Friday, so I scheduled a meeting internally with the department staff to say, look, if we commit to a work group, do the people at the department commit to the possibility that there is a solution that's workable other than the current situation? And so I haven't had that meeting yet. It's scheduled for tomorrow or Wednesday, I believe. But I'm hopeful that there would be something we could do to come to the table. It would be a workaround, but something that might address that situation. There could be a range of solutions, from a narrow carving out of, say, all warehouses and distribution centers are classed as, and then put that in the law. That would certainly fix a particular person's situation and people in that unique category. Or there could be other types of solutions that are a little broader.
Thank you. Thank you, John. And I believe that work group would be welcomed to look at this issue. Could you explain the rule that was implemented, which seemed to turn this issue on its head a little bit, and what existed prior to the rule change versus what is now in place post-rule change?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I can, to some extent. I wasn't really around working in that particular area at the time, but what I can tell you from people who were was that the rule had been discussed for a long time. What we're talking about in this bill is one sentence in the rule, and it's a very significantly large rule. So the counties had gone along implementing it. Pretty soon we learned that not all of them were complying with it. There was a lot of non-uniformity going on out there. We had people who fought on both sides of the fence with this issue, and they came around after 3 years of discussion on the rule, debating it back and forth, holding long, extensive meetings about how it should be implemented. Finally, they decided, and I think it was 2006, and at that point they decided, well, look, we can't agree on what it is. The department, why don't you just decide? So then that's when we went to the manual and just said to the Appraisers Institute that talks about appraising property based on its the property, not just the land. And we said, well, we think this is what it should be based on the discipline of appraisal. And so we wrote the rule and gave everybody 2 years to implement it because it was such an involved process. What we were finding in problems with the rule at the time we started these discussions was, one, the rule doesn't address all kinds of property. If the highest and best use is based on the land and you have property that has no land connection, like personal property or utility property, then the rule doesn't work for that. If you have property that's in transition, such as Liberty Road coming into town here, you might notice that at one time that was all residential. Then it was zoned to be acceptable for other kinds of development. Now you have dentist office, you have eye doctors, you have therapists, you have dialysis units. And so if the zoning was one thing, but the use was another, it didn't make sense to stick with the zoning. The highest and best use of a property, even if it's zoned residential, but it's a commercial business, seems like a prudent person wouldn't buy the property, tear down the commercial, and then build a residence. So the highest and best use was as a commercial. So properties are in transition. It did make sense that, and the Appraisal Institute does say that if you appraise a class property based on the land only, and it is land, that's appropriate. But if it's improved, then you should class it based on the land as improved. And then, the final one is just the fact that there's zoning between communities and jurisdictions is so disparate that there's a lot of conflicts with zoning, and I think that's what Mr. Chandler was talking about. You're having properties that are in land zone other than what they're being used for. So it creates a lot of conflict when you go just to look at what the land is.
Does this have to do with how machinery and equipment is assessed? If you have the building is exactly the same, but you have processing and machinery equipment in one, and you're just storing whatever in the other with no processing involved at all. What this rule did, it lumped those two into the same classification, those two uses.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, The rule was designed for the mass appraisal system, so it wasn't really intended to create a special tax consequence under Measure 50. It's just what's happened. But the industrial property with industrial machinery on industrial land, all treated as industrial. But the point you bring up is really important to the conversation, because it is the machinery and equipment that's in these properties that depreciates so quickly. And you'll see, of course, if you look at Intel, which was brought up earlier, some high-tech firm in Washington County, the changed property ratio is set at 1, but in reality, the changed property ratio in Washington County for those kinds of high-tech businesses is approximately 1.25 right now. So in other words, the maximum assessed value under Measure 50 and the real market value, the one is 125% higher than the market value because it depreciates so fast. So what's depreciating is not the building, and what's depreciating is not the land, it's It's the technology and the machinery and equipment that's depreciating, and that's what creates the high change to property ratio.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Well, Madam Chair, I would hope that this would not be the last discussion on this issue of equitable treatment of warehouse properties.
Yeah, I would really like to pursue the work group idea and try to, again, I feel like the kid with his finger in the dike anytime one of these Measure 50 things comes up, but this seems like a particularly egregious case. I wanted to thank you, Senator Morse, for bringing it to our attention and focusing attention on it. So we will hear more about this.
If it pleases the committee, I can report back perhaps to yourself or Senator Morris on the results of that discussion this week.
That would be great if you would report to Senator Morris. He's the one most on top of this.
And then what I'd prefer to do is then to get together with a representative group of the county assessors and say, you know, are you on board with this? Is this something we can work with? And that way we'd go into this before the legislature ends. We can go into it with a charge and a willingness to come to a solution.
Okay. Thank you. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 818, and I believe if there's no further business, Madam Chair, we are adjourned. Are adjourned.